Well, early this morning, word from the Lansing Board of Water and Light that the Scott Center House will be saved from demolition and moved to a nearby location. The BWL Steve Sirkayan writes that a plan will be unveiled at 10 o'clock this morning. We're coming to you here live or recorded, one form or the other, here just after 9 o'clock Eastern Time on Tuesday. But at 10 a.m. today, we will learn more. Apparently at South Martin Luther King Boulevard between West Lenaway and West Hillsdale Streets, the relocation of the structure, a significant step forward in making room to build the BWL's $26 million central substation, which, according to the release from the utility, is a vital step toward retiring the environmentally unsustainable coal-fired Eckert Power Station by 2020. Mayor Bernero, BWL General Manager Dick Pefley, and other community partners all scheduled to be a part of that gathering at 10 o'clock here today. Welcome back to Current State. We are back with you in Studio S. I'm Mark Bayshore. It is the last day of the month. I think everybody has moved on to a kind of a summer mindset here with the long weekend and with Memorial Day behind us. But it is the 31st of the month, as we do on the last workday of every month. We look back on some of Michigan's biggest news stories. And for that help here today, we welcome the Detroit News' Jonathan Osteen. Good to see you, Jonathan.
Thank you.
And of the BallingerReport.com, Bill Ballinger in Studio S. Good to see you, sir.
Good morning.
For weeks, we've heard about competing plans, one in the State House, one in the Senate, for bailing out and then relaunching the Detroit Public Schools. The reporting seems to suggest that a plan could be voted on very soon. What kind of plan or plans have emerged that will likely be voted on? Bill?
Well, the Senate plan basically has more money in it, startup money for the Detroit School District, some $200 million, than the House plan, which has something like $33 million, I think, in it.
This is to launch the new district.
To launch the new district. Both seemingly agree at this point on this figure of about $500 million and change overall over 10 years that Governor Snyder recommended. And the Detroit Education Commission, which would be created by the Senate version of the plan, has run into a lot of resistance from the House. The House passed a plan without it. It's back being negotiated on by House and Senate members. Mainly, it's up to the Senate right now to decide whether it accepts the House plan, and obviously I don't think it will. Question is there going to be a compromise? What's going to be the nature of the compromise? And that's where we are right now.
And as of last week, it sounded like both the legislative leaders, the Senate Majority Leader Alan Meekoff, House Speaker Kevin Cotter, were willing to compromise on those things, which is itself sort of a breakthrough here. Speaker Cotter has been adamant that he doesn't want the Detroit Education Commission to be part of this deal. Meekoff said he wasn't going to let one issue get in the way of a deal. Then Cotter also went back and said, well, you know, maybe you could call something a Detroit Education Commission, but change the way it works because he doesn't like how it functioned in that Senate.
Yeah, let me just mention the House is really fearful that it gives too much power, this commission, to the mayor, Mike Duggan, to potentially close down charter schools in Detroit or some charter schools that he may not like. So that's the House fear right there. Secondly, let me just point out one other overarching political aspect of this. All the House members this year, 110, they're running for election or re-election, okay? Guess what? The Senate is not running for election this year. And in fact, most of them will never run for the Senate again because they're term limited. And the governor is not running. So politically, the people who have most at stake are in the House. Mm-hmm. And most of these people don't live in Detroit, in case you haven't noticed. Mm-hmm. They're outstate and their districts and the people who live in them are not wildly enthusiastic about what they perceive as another bailout for Detroit.
We'll also point out that as we speak here, just after 9 a.m. Eastern time, that Mayor Mike Duggan has convened a meeting in Detroit and is either meeting now or will be meeting shortly with a number of Detroit charter school operators. I think, according to the reports, to try to get more support from the charter operators themselves for a Detroit Education Commission.
Sure. The charter lobby in Lansing seems to be very uniformly against this, but Duggan is trying to appeal to some of the actual school operators and say, listen, the worst case scenarios you've heard are not true. If this is a mayoral appointed committee, I'm not going to be aggressively shutting down charters. Duggan says he supports school choice, but he thinks bad schools of any kind, whether that's a charter, traditional public, should be shut down. And he also wants to be able to have some control over where these schools locate, so you don't have a charter opening up directly across the street from a public school in a neighborhood that is already well served, and then you have an education oasis in another spot where there is no school.
And that is part of the educational landscape in the city of Detroit right now.
Right.
It's very chaotic in terms of what schools open where, et cetera, et cetera.
And there's a big interplay between charters. Charters now educate as many, maybe even more students than the traditional Detroit public schools do. So there is some speculation. Can both survive? If charters continue to grow, will that continue to hurt the population, student population of DPS, which of course districts rely on per pupil funding for the state to operate? So that's, you know, that's a, it is a interesting dynamic, and both sides are very interested in how that dynamic plays out.
Tens of thousands of Detroit school kids do attend charter schools in the city. How quickly could some kind of measure emerge here, Bill?
With the legislature,
is this going to drag out for? Well, this has been on the table for a while. Could this drag on quite a bit longer, or do you think you expect something this week?
Well, I think it could happen this week, but probably not. But I think by the time they adjourn this summer, I think maybe something will happen. With the legislature, as Jonathan knows, you never can tell. Something can drag on for weeks, and you think, aren't they ever going to get this done? And then all of a sudden, in a blitzkrieg overnight, something happens and comes together, and they can take a quick vote. So
there,
we just never
there
know.
There is some incentive for the legislature to act this month, certainly. The school's financial year ends at the end of this month, and once that happens, that's when the district could actually start to go insolvent. Creditors
well,
could start...
the end of this month. You mean June, don't you?
Yes.
Okay.
Yes.
Today is May. It's still May.
I jumped ahead, like you said earlier, Mark.
Hours away.
So if a deal's going to happen, it'll be next. It'll be in June. Otherwise, this worst-case scenario of bankruptcy could happen. Of course, the whole talk about a bailout is to help DPS with their debt. If they don't resolve that issue, creditors could start demanding the district pay. They could take them to bankruptcy court. And because the state guarantees a lot of the loans and a lot of the district debt, taxpayers might be end up on the hook for a bigger bill.
Jonathan Osting of the Detroit News, Bill Ballinger of the BallingerReport.com here joining me on May's Month in Review on WKAR's Current State. We learned last week that the state is taking in less revenue than previously forecast, and I've heard a number of figures in circulation. How much less does Michigan have than originally projected?
Well, they're projecting maybe $460 million less over two fiscal years, or less. Let's put it this way, the part of this fiscal year we're in and the next full one. So it's not quite as dire as it sounds when you say $460 million like this current year or anything like that. And secondly, you stated it right. It's less than projected, meaning they're not getting as much revenue as they thought they would, but they thought they'd be getting a lot more revenue than a year ago. And they're now revising that, saying we're not getting the money coming in as fast as we thought we would, so we're going to have to revise it down. But frankly, there hasn't been a lot of furor about this. Even the Democrats have been pretty mild. They've been critical and say, yes, again, Rick Snyder never should have cut, corporate business taxes the way he did in 2011. We wouldn't be in this pickle. That's another story. We could debate that if you want to. But the point is, nobody's really in an uproar, and they think that they can whittle away at the budget, projected budget shortfall that they're having because of these revenue estimates without doing major damage.
Sure. Without major damage, but some, but we're still talking about cutting, aren't we, Jonathan?
Yeah, well, as Bill stated, we're cutting from an increase. So, for instance, higher education funding, important here in Michigan State. The governor had proposed increasing higher ed funding to $60 million, which would have actually restored 2011 university operation funding levels. Remember, the governor made a big cut his first year in office. So he wanted to get universities all the way back to that point. Instead, they're going to approve a $40 million increase for university operations. So there's more money for universities, but still not as much as they wanted, okay. And still less in this case than in 2011.
Remind us, there was a big infrastructure piece, well, $165 million in infrastructure spending in the governor's budget. Will that be cut, and will help for Flint become a part of this landscape?
Well, that's another... Those are other questions that are going to have to be resolved, and they could be impacted slightly, yes.
The Flint-specific funding looks to be safe, but what you're talking about, the infrastructure fund, this was going to be a statewide infrastructure fund for the governor to say, hey, not just Flint has these aging pipes. There are other cities around the state that probably would do well to start addressing these issues well, and maybe the state could help kick in there. That is going to be scaled back, according to the budget leaders, from $165 million, which itself, the governor said, was just going to be seed money for a larger effort. It's going to be scaled back next year to $5 million. So probably not a lot is actually going to be able to happen out of that fund next year.
Why, kind of an accounting question here, or an economics question, why is less coming in than anticipated?
Well, a couple reasons. A big reason is business taxes. The state, as Bill mentioned, the governor and legislature did change tax policy in 2012, major tax code rewrite. But part of this issue is we still have these lingering tax credits that were mostly issued under the Granholm era. Those continue to be refunded at a very high rate. And then this year, you also had the new corporate income tax, which is proving to be volatile, was down lower than expected. The combination of those two principal business taxes means the state's actually projected to lose money on the corporate income tax and the Michigan business tax combined next year, about $99 million. So it's sort of two policies from the Granholm and Snyder conflicting with each other and looking pretty messy right now.
Either conflicting or teaming up to wreak havoc
sure.
with the state
sure.
budget.
When is the budget expected to arrive on the governor's desk? Is that unpredictable?
They want
on
it done by the 4th of
weeks.
July, certainly, don't they?
Well, yeah, again, they're breaking for summer break. This plan is still to break by the middle towards late June. So they're hoping to still get this done in the next few weeks.
Jonathan Oesting of the Detroit News, Bill Ballinger of theballingerreport.com here on WKAR's Current State and our May month in review. Last week, law enforcement officials on both the state and federal levels requested an end to the Snyder administration's internal inquiry into the state's handling of the Flint water crisis. The administration complied. Why the request to end the investigation, Bill?
They thought it was interfering with what they were trying to do, they being the Attorney General and David Layton, the Genesee County prosecutor, and the federal government. They just felt, look, we're looking at this and we're running into either resistance or conflict from the Snyder administration doing their own internal review. And I must say, frankly, if you're going to have a credible review of what the Snyder administration did or did not do with respect to the Flint water crisis, it shouldn't be being done by the Snyder administration. It's the old fox watching the chicken coop metaphor. Mm-hmm. And the public wants to see a relatively independent outside entity. Now, you could argue that Bill Schuette is a Republican attorney general, so maybe he's not too objective either. But you've got David Layton, a Democrat in Genesee County. You've got the federal government. And everybody thinks these people are trying to do the right thing and get at answers objectively. And if they see that they're having problems for any reason, whatever it might be, get the Snyder administration out of it. And frankly, I think the Snyder administration would be well advised to get out of it.
For the record, here is Attorney General Bill Schuette last Thursday.
It became increasingly clear that we needed to make sure that nothing would impede the criminal investigation to make sure that we provide justice to families of Flint.
Did the governor comply reluctantly, Jonathan? I mean, are there reasons that he would have preferred to continue?
I don't know. I mean, he was quick to comply with the order, from Bill Schuette and from U.S. Attorney General's office. They sent him a letter, I think it was the same day or the next day, that they did, in fact, request the Auditor General to end their investigation, and the MSP one, I believe, had already wrapped up. So they certainly moved quickly to comply. I think it looked bad for the administration. I think what it showed is probably there was a communication breakdown. I mean, the Attorney General's office said they weren't even originally aware that the Michigan State Police had investigated the Michigan Department of Environmental Quality. It sounds like two of the state's top-ranking officials probably could have at least sent an email to each other to let each other know what was going on here.
Let's talk a little politics here. A few weeks ago, Democrat Melissa Gilbert dropped out of the race for Congress in our district here in East Lansing, the 8th, citing health reasons. Bill, can you walk us through the Democrats' options here regarding a name on the ballot come November?
Well, first of all, they've got to decide categorically, can they get Melissa Gilbert's name off the ballot? I mean, that is the
big problem.
I've heard
they can't.
Yeah, well, that's...
Her name will be on the
ballot.
That
is a problem. She is citing physically unable to perform and some special reason why her name should be removed from the ballot, at least after the August primary. Whether that's going to fly or not remains to be seen. We're in uncharted territory here. There really has not been a case like this ever, probably, at least in the last half century, precisely like this. So that's, the first question. And the second question is whether her name remains on the ballot or not. Will the Democrats try to come up with another nominee who would also be on the ballot in some way, shape, or form? You can debate that eternally. Frankly, the Democrats may not want to admit this, but this is not a Democratic district. I know Lansing and Ingham County seems to think it is or should be or could be, but it's not. And I think Melissa Gilbert had an uphill struggle anyway, and she'd run a terrible campaign from the very beginning for this office. It's probably just as well she got out of the race. The problem is she got out too late. If she was going to be that bad, she should have quit for whatever reason, health or otherwise, long before she did, and they would have had a chance to come up with somebody who was more credible.
Sure. The big question now is if Melissa Gilbert did get her name pulled from the ballot, is a top-tier Democratic candidate going to want to enter this race this late in the game? Seems unlikely. The Dems say this is still a priority district for them, but obviously Republicans have been laying the groundwork for a healthy campaign for a while now and are going to have a big head start.
Well, Democratic State Chief Brandon Dillon told Michigan's Big Show last week that he brought up Donald Trump and maintained that Donald Trump is going to, quote, going to be an incredible drag on the Republican ticket, and that from Brandon Dillon's point of view, that makes Bishop more vulnerable than he otherwise would be. Interestingly, we've seen Donald Trump's numbers go up noticeably just in recent days.
Remember, Brandon Dillon is chairman of the Michigan Democratic Party. That's what he says. That's what he does for a living. Secondly, Hillary Clinton's numbers are not too far away from Donald Trump's. So before you start dismissing every Republican on the ballot because he's on the same ticket with Donald Trump, maybe you better start worrying about whether Hillary Clinton is going to be that much of a help, if not a hindrance, to Democratic candidates.
Are you off to Mackinac Island, Jonathan?
Maybe, probably. Still not sure. The legislature is very up in the air this week in terms of what they're going to do. So if they do something big like DPS, I'll be here.
Bill, what about
you? I will not be up there. And apparently, maybe, as Jonathan said, maybe the legislature won't either.
And we could see a vote on energy legislation very soon, Jonathan?
That's correct, yeah. An energy package passed out of a Senate committee last week. The Republican Republicans in the Senate are going to caucus this morning. They're going to get behind closed doors, talk about it. And there's a big push to try and get a vote as soon as today.
May is a busy month, as I think our guests have demonstrated here. Thanks for all the perspective that both of you bring. Jonathan Osting of the Detroit News, Bill Ballinger, theballingerreport.com. Thanks very much. And coming up on Current State, a Wisconsin town wants to divert water from Lake Michigan because its own drinking water supply is contaminated. Now the city of Waukesha is one step closer to its goal. We'll get the latest on the Waukesha water diversion and other issues with Great Lakes commentator Gary Wilson. He joins us for the May edition of the Great Lakes Month in Review. That is on the way. Well, this time of year, the Great Lakes teams with ocean-bound shipping traffic headed to locations all around the globe. Ann Arbor's Roger Lefevre is well acquainted with the big ships. Lefevre spent his childhood in Sault Ste. Marie and grew up watching immense freighters sail the lakes and the locks. At age 17, he spent a summer working aboard the Ernest R. Breach. Now, the Breach was among the Ford Motor Company's fleet of ships, hauling raw materials for the auto industry. Ford ships also carried auto VIPs who traveled in style and comfort in passenger quarters. Roger Lefevre spent his summer of 73 as a porter aboard the Breach. WKAR's Peter Worf speaks with Roger, who tells his sailing story in the Michigan History Magazine article titled Shipping Out for the Summer.
Growing up in the Sioux back in the 70s, it was very common for young people who are going away to college who wanted to make a lot of money in a short period of time for school to ship out on the freighters. There were a lot more ships back then and a lot more opportunities to do that. So I kind of followed the route of many young people of my age up in Sault Ste. Marie. But I had the added interest of possibly making that my career. So I turned 18, and I went to the U.S. Coast Guard, and I got my Merchant Mariner's document, and I secured a letter from the Ford Motor Company stating that they'd be willing to hire me. So that was proof enough for the Coast Guard that I had a job waiting for me. And I graduated from high school, and I waited basically for my ship to come in. It only took about 2 weeks. I got offered a job with Ford Motor Company as a passenger porter. And I went over to the Sioux Locks one very foggy night. My mother drove me over, and I climbed on board the ship, and there I was.
So merry are we. No mortals on earth are as happy as we. Sing hide, every down. If sailor boys grog and there's nothing goes wrong.
Remember what it was like when you first set foot on board. Tell me about how you felt.
I was thrilled and absolutely terrified. It was my first time away from home. I was going into this absolutely unfamiliar and new world. They took me back. It was night, so they took me back to my room and introduced me to my bunkmate, my roommate back there, and I went to bed and didn't get a wink of sleep. I woke up in the morning and I was issued a pair of galley whites and put to work. I say I was just absolutely terrified.
What was your job as a porter for passengers? Tell me about that job and what life was like for you working, and what was life like for the passenger?
Well, the Ford fleet carried non-paying passengers as guests of the company, which still happens sometimes on some of the ships. And that would be executives of the company, their wives, clients of the company, their wives and families. We carried 8 passengers per trip. We had very luxurious quarters for them, and they had their own dining room and their own galley and their own cook, and I was their personal porter, which meant that I got to hump all their luggage on board in the back end of the ship and push it in a cart all the way up to the front and unload it for them and clean the rooms and make their beds and wipe up the debris from their partying and revelry of the night before. Alcohol flowed freely, and they played a lot of cards, and they made quite a mess. So while they were at breakfast, I got to clean up the rooms. I set the tables, and I made sure that all the laundry and linens were changed and basically just catered to their every whim.
Tell me about your off time. What did you do to pass the time and enjoy your time on the water?
I read a lot. I love to take a blanket and a pillow up to the back deck there by the lifeboats and lay in the sun. Of course, I only worked at mealtimes, which meant I had a nice break in the afternoon after lunch. So that's typically what I'd do on a nice day is I'd take a little radio and a book and a pillow and go up and sit in the sun and watch the waves go by.
Sweet Mother Michigan, Father Superior, coming down from Mackinac and Sault Ste. Marie. Blue water Huron rolls down to Lake Erie, falls into Ontario and runs on out to sea.
Tell me about your ports of call and the routes that you took.
Our ports of call were almost the same every trip. Since we were a Ford Motor Company ship, we unloaded our cargo every trip at the River Rouge dock. And we took on our cargo either in Marquette, Michigan or Duluth, Minnesota, depending on the needs of the company and the availability of the dock. So it was Lake Superior to Detroit, back and forth.
Right. I'm speaking with Roger Leliever, author of the recent article for Michigan History Magazine, Shipping Out for the Summer. He tells about summer in 1973 as a young man working aboard the Ernest R. Breach, a Ford Motor Company steamer. You tell some really evocative and detailed stories about some of your crewmates, one of them your bunkmate, who was a hairdresser.
Yes, he is a licensed hairdresser from California. And what he was doing on a Great Lakes freighter, I never did really find out. He had a mannequin head with a wig on it, and he would practice, and he would chat with the mannequin head while he was doing it. And I would just pull my curtain a little tighter around my bunk.
What sorts of things did he say to his mannequin head?
Oh, he'd say, oh, when we get to Detroit, I'm going to take you out dancing on the town, And you're the only girl that was ever true to me. He called her Chiquita because there was a Chiquita banana sticker that was stuck to the back of the mannequin. Very interesting fellow.
That's hilarious.
He was the second cook.
In preparing for our conversation today, Roger, you inspired me to get online and look at some ships and mm-hmm. look at Know Your Ships online and also to listen to the incredible different voices of ship's horns.
Oh, yes, yes.
Just listening to one after the other to me was like listening to the horns of the apocalypse or something. Describe what it's like, sort of the different voices and the volume of these horns.
If you're around the water enough, you're able to tell what ship it is by the horn. And when I was growing up in the Sioux, there was one ship, the Edward L. Ryerson, and it was the only one that shook the windows when it blew the whistle. It had just the right frequency.
Can you describe what a ship's horn sounds like in port or up close? It must be deafening.
It's really loud. It's strident, and it can be very deep-throated. And it can blot everything else out. I got to blow a ship's whistle once, and it was the thrill of a lifetime to feel like I had so much power in my hand.
Wow, what vessel was that?
That was my favorite, the Edward L. Ryerson. Yeah.
Very good. Shipping Out for the Summer, that's the article in a recent issue of Michigan History Magazine by Roger Leliever. And we've been talking about that article and his interest in life on the Great Lakes. Hey, Roger, thanks a lot for talking with us today on Current State.
I loved it. Thank you very much for thinking of me.
For Current State, this is Peter Wharf.
And coming up on Current State, before there was Hamilton, there was Rent. We'll speak with the cast and director of the Riverwalk Theater's production of this Pulitzer Prize-winning musical set during the AIDS crisis of the mid-1990s. That and more after the break on Current State. Without help from current state listeners just like you, WKAR would sound like any other radio station, but because of listeners like you, WKAR is different and better. A friendly request to help us continue to bring extraordinary programs to you and your community. Use the Give Now link at WKAR.org, and we thank you. I'm Mark Bayshore. For months, a panel representing the 8 U.S. states and 2 Canadian provinces that border the Great Lakes have been deliberating over a request by the city of Waukesha, Wisconsin, to divert water from Lake Michigan. Waukesha is an inland suburb west of Milwaukee. The city's own well water supply is contaminated by radium, so Waukesha is under an EPA mandate to find another source. Now, since we talked about Waukesha last month, the Wisconsin city moved closer to getting its wish. The panel voted to approve the city's request, but with 2 key conditions. Here with the latest on the Waukesha issue and other environmental stories that made the news in May is current state's Great Lakes commentator Gary Wilson. Gary, welcome back.
Hey, Mark. Belated Happy Memorial Day, and good to be back with you, as always.
Same to you. Hope you had a great holiday weekend. The bottom line for the community of Waukesha appears to be that it got what it needs, but the panel said no to these towns in its service area. Remind our listeners why water for this larger service area was also important to Waukesha.
Sure, Mark. When this process started, it started formally 5 years ago, and informally well before that. But the city of Waukesha has towns that border it that don't currently get water via the city of Waukesha and don't have a need for it. They don't have the radium problem that the city of Waukesha does. But the state of Waukesha, state of Wisconsin, in all of its wisdom, decided to include the these bordering towns in Waukesha's request, and they codified that in a law that Waukesha would have to be able to provide water to this service area. And that was controversial and tricky, and it turned out to be a non-starter for the city of Waukesha. The states were very clear, saying there's no provision in the compact for a service area. If these towns have a need for water, they should apply for it just like Waukesha did. So during the process over the last couple of weeks, that was quickly dismissed.
Well, how are city leaders responding to the decision? Are they more pleased with this decision, or are they displeased on behalf of these surrounding communities?
Well, it depends, Mark. I think, you know, privately they are displeased. They wanted those bordering towns to be part of that service area, to be part of what they would provide at some point in time. Publicly, they've got their good behavior hats on. They say, okay, we understand that's a compromise that needs to be made, and we accept it. The future of their water supply here hangs on the balance, so they aren't going to do anything controversial. And I spoke with Dan Dukniak, the director of Waukesha's Water Department, and he was resigned that the service areas had to go.
And to be clear, this is still not formally over with. This recommendation goes to all of the Great Lakes state governors. They have the final say, correct?
They do. They'll meet on June 21st, and I'm not sure if the governors themselves will meet. They certainly could if it was their desire. More likely, official designees will meet in Chicago on June 21st to vote. This will be the final word. It takes a unanimous vote to approve Waukesha's request. One vote against, and the request is denied. And they've got 3 options. They can approve the Waukesha's request as it was submitted, and that won't happen. That's already out the door. Or they could approve it with conditions, which appears to be likely, or they could just flat-out deny it. And we'll have to see what happens on June 21st, but that will be the final word.
Do you have any insights on how you feel how this vote will turn out?
Logically, the table has been set for the governors to approve it. This panel that you referred to, the regional body, are designees of the governors. Their process is codified into the law. This was a formal review process with a recommendation to the governors that Waukesha's request be approved with conditions. So at this point, if the governors said no, they would be going against the recommendation of their designees, who are experts in the area. So the governors might have some explaining to do if they say no.
And what adds to the urgency of this situation, as I understand it, is its precedent-setting nature. If the governors approve the request, could other cities and towns along the divide of the Great Lakes Basin get in line for Great Lakes water? How, and is that scenario weighing on all of the governor's minds?
Yeah, I think the precedent-setting issue that we keep talking about, and I've been guilty of this, is it's certainly there, but I think it's a little bit overblown. There are about eight other cities that straddle the divide, or they're in a county that straddles the divide, and they could be candidates for water to follow Waukesha's path. But I'm not sure that they will. As I said, this was a formal five-year process for Waukesha to get to this point. It wasn't easy. There was a lot of rigor in the process. It was expensive to apply. And, you know, I think these cities will have to think, do we really want to go through all this, or should we be looking at alternatives? So my take on it is the Great Lakes Compact is pretty much working here.
We are talking with Great Lakes commentator Gary Wilson, who joins us around this time each month to review the biggest issues making news in the Great Lakes region. Let's shift to another topic. Invasive species are a perennial concern on the Great Lakes, and not just Asian carp. Many unwanted species come in through ballast water that's dumped into the Great Lakes by ocean-going vessels. Zebra and quagga mussels are the best example. I guess there are an estimated 10 million zebra and quagga mussels in the Great Lakes. Right now, ballast water is regulated jointly by the Coast Guard and the U.S. EPA, but there's pending legislation in Congress that would take that authority away from EPA and give it exclusively to the Coast Guard. What is happening here, Gary? Help us understand.
Sure, Mark. This has been a push and pull going on with regulating ballast water for years. Right now, the responsibility rests jointly with the U.S. EPA and the Coast Guard. And members in Congress, primarily in the House of Representatives, but in the Senate too, would like to take that authority away from the EPA and give it exclusively to the Coast Guard. Now, there are a couple of issues there. First of all, EPA is the primary enforcer of regulations, and that's done via the Clean Water Act, the landmark legislation that allows entities like the EPA and others to bring legal action against polluters. In this case, it would be the shipping industry. But giving it to the authority solely to the Coast Guard is, many think is problematic. Coast Guard has a broader mission than regulating the ballast water. They're in charge of shipping, they're interdicting, life-saving. They've got a bigger role, and the fear is that this will be a low priority for the Coast Guard. So that's why many folks, including the environmental folks especially, are concerned about this.
How could lakeside communities in Michigan protect their interests if they no longer have the mechanism to sue a commercial shipping line for environmental transgressions under the Clean Water Act? That seems to be a concern here, too.
It is a concern. It's a legitimate concern. It really hinders their ability to do anything. They would be reliant on state laws if there were state laws. It makes their path toward a remedy much more difficult. It just leaves them without a whole lot of good options. That's why there's such a hubbub and such interest over trying to get this change in the law right. People are very concerned about it.
We have been talking with Great Lakes commentator Gary Wilson about some of the biggest issues making news in the Great Lakes region for May, among them a panel vote in favor of granting a water diversion request by the city of Waukesha, Wisconsin, but with conditions. We will see how that plays out on later next month. Gary, thanks as always.
Nice to be with you, Mike. Talk to you next month.
This segment is supported by Michigan State University's Knight Center for Environmental Journalism. More news about the Great Lakes environment can be found at greatlakesecho.org and on Current State every Tuesday as part of our partnership. It's Current State on 90.5 WKAR, always at WKAR.org. 20 years before the Broadway smash hit Hamilton, there was Jonathan Larson's Rent. Set in New York City during the AIDS crisis of the mid-1990s, the musical was a retelling of the Puccini opera La Boheme, and it took America by storm. Along the way, Rent garnered Tony and Drama Desk Awards, as well as winning the Pulitzer Prize for Drama in 1996. The musical comes to the Riverwalk Theater for the next 2 weekends, and the theater also has a special performance on Wednesday the 8th to benefit the Lansing Area AIDS Network. Current State's Jamie Paisley sat in on one of the rehearsals last week and spoke with the director as well as a few cast members, one of whom took a drastic step to be a part of the production.
I had two jobs. I gave up my second job to make time for this because I'd never had the opportunity to do Rent before, so it meant a lot to me.
That's Jake McCaskill, who portrays the character of Tom Collins.
I've never seen the stage version. I've only ever seen the movie. I saw it when I was like 11, though. It was the first musical that really got me into musicals, so it meant a lot to me when I heard about this. I am from Lansing. I mean, I moved to Florida a few years ago, and then I moved back, so I've been around. But I didn't even know this theater was here until a techie friend of mine told me about it. So I was pretty busy, kind of focused on just coming out of college and just working and making money. But when I heard that they were doing Rent, I was like, okay, I'll give it a shot. Plus everyone, all of my friends were telling me, you need to audition for Rent, you need to do theater. So I was like, okay, I'll give it a shot.
There's an interesting pairing of songs that Tom Collins sings. It's essentially the same song, I'll Cover You, but it's sung in two very different styles. First is happy, and second, more somber, so to speak. So how do you prepare for that emotional swing?
Well, it really comes out of the significance of the second version, because the first one is a birth of something very joyous and beautiful, and the second is, it symbolizes the end to a very special chapter of my life, and so I invest in the journey that I had, and the relationship that I had, and the love that I felt.
I am Kelly Stable-Clark, and I am directing Rent at Riverwalk Theater.
We're at an age, by the way, that there's more distance between now and Rent than between Rent and Evita. Mm-hmm. Is that odd to you?
It is very odd, but that's also the reason that I wanted to bring Rent back to the stage. I was, I think, in 10th grade when I remember very distinctly when I first put that CD into my Discman, and it was a Discman, and I heard that guitar tune up. And before that, I'd only ever listened to Rodgers and Hammerstein and Phantom of the Opera, and I thought, what is this? And then they started cursing, and then they started, you know, it's like, okay, this is very different. And I thought about it, and that was, you know, 20 years ago when it opened on Broadway. And the last time I saw Rent was about 10 years ago, and I remembered thinking, I'm bored with this. I've seen it enough. You know, it's kind of played out. And by that time, you know, Spring Awakening was around, and Next to Normal and all these other really exciting rock musicals had kind of taken its place. And I looked at the calendar and I thought, 2016, that's 20 years. And I kind of just wanted to be able to look and see what that 20 years meant to me personally and my relationship with the show, but also to what, you know, has happened with the culture of HIV and AIDS and, you know, stereotyping gay people and drag queens. And that, so that distance is exactly why I wanted to do this show this year.
along those same lines. We're just listening to a bit of the rehearsal of the first part of La Vie Boheme with a whole lot of references. Do any of those feel really dated to you? Like AZT, that's something that's not as prevalent, I think, that's around.
Right. And actually what we did was we got Dr. Peter Gulick, who is a doctor of infectious disease and was one of the main doctors who worked with HIV patients in Columbus or Toledo in Ohio, when it was first coming around in the mid-80s. And so he came early on and gave us basically the history of HIV AIDS and told us that, you know, AZT was kind of winding its way down in 95. So by the time Rent was on Broadway, AZT wasn't that, you know, they had started introducing these cocktails instead of AZT. And we had fun kind of explaining some of the references in La Vie Boheme, especially that, you know, 20 years ago, those were huge counterculture icons and theories and people and movements. And now it's like, I got to Google that one, you know, because not everybody is familiar with what they meant.
In this Riverwalk Theater production of the Pulitzer-winning musical Rent, opening this weekend, Alexandria Clift portrays the role of the lesbian lawyer Joanne Jefferson. Joanne is rather a controlling yet put-upon figure in the show, and she may have some similarities to Alexandria herself.
Yes, to a certain extent. I mean, she's very driven and knows what she wants, and obviously because she's, you know, she's a lawyer. So, and I've always been someone who I don't necessarily go by lists, but, you know, everything needs to be a certain way, and I like some order to things, at least order within the chaos. So I can definitely relate to her on that aspect. And her relationship with Maureen is a very interesting one because it's a prime example of opposites attract. So it's funny, though, because usually I'm more like Maureen in real life. And so it's been interesting dating someone that's like that, like in the show. So it's very, very interesting.
As far as vocally, Joanne is not, to be honest, she's more of a supporting character. And there's the duet that's obviously fantastic. Is it a challenge for you, this role, vocally?
Not really. Vocally, she actually has almost the same amount of songs as the principals do. And I actually have one song that's just my own called We're Okay. And that one's pretty funny because I learned how to juggle two phones with speaking to three different people. So out of all of the pieces, it was, you would think, the simplest song. It's quite short. But every time I was going through it, I'm like, oh, wait, did I click over on the other line? Who am I talking to now? So, yeah, but it's been very nice. And she's usually singing along with the men, which is, I think, is just hilarious because, you know, obviously the description of Joanne is a hardcore lesbian lawyer, as they like to put it. So it's been very fun. And it's been nice with all the other supporting characters working in and trying to, like, mesh everyone's voice together. And I think that this group really blends very well.
Again, director of the upcoming Riverwalk Theater production of Rent, Kelly Steibel-Clark.
It's interesting because there's several scenes where it's all 19 actors on stage and they're all doing something different. And so that was a challenge both for myself and our music director teaching all those different parts. But what I've loved in the last couple of nights watching the runs, I'm seeing all the individual moments and, you know, just little asides, little conversations, little things that are happening. So it makes it so much more fun to watch. Although it was, you know, a nightmare trying to get everybody's paths so nobody's running into each other and forgetting what they're doing. But it gives the audience, especially since we're on the thrust stage, if you're sitting off on the side, you're going to see so many little stories come out in these big scenes versus just the two main people, perhaps, you know, that you'd see if you're sitting right down in front.
5, 5, 5, 6, 5, 6, 5, 6, 5, 6, 5, 6, 5, 6, 5, 6, 5, 6, 5, 6, 5, 6, 5, 6, 5, 6, 5, 6, 5, 6, 5, 6, 5, 6, 5, 6, 5, 6, 5, 6, 5, 6, 5, 6, 5, 6, 5, 6, 5, 6, 5, 6, 5, 6, 5, 6, 5, 6, 5, 6, 5, 6, 5, 6, 5, 6, 5, 6, 5, 6, 5, 6, 5, 6, 5, 6, 5, 6, 5, 6, 5, 6, 5, 6, 5, 6, 5, 6, 5, 6, 5, 6, 5, 6, 5, 6, 5, 6, 5, 6, 5, 6, 5, 6, 5, 6, 5, 6, 5, 6, 5, 6, 5, 6, 5, 6, 5, 6, 5, 6, 5, 6, 5, 6, 5, 6, 5 Lansing, with a special benefit performance Wednesday, June 8th for the Lansing Area AIDS Network. More information at riverwalktheater.com. For Current State, I'm Jamie Paisley.
And that's our show for today. We're glad you could join us. Tomorrow on Current State, a plan to create bus rapid transit service between the state capitol and the Meridian Mall has its supporters and opponents. We'll hear from both sides. CATA's Deb Alexander joins me to explain and defend the plan. The owner of an Okemos business explains how she thinks it's going to hurt. Yvonne Lefebvre of Lansing Go Green Trikes takes us on a special delivery, and we'll check in with Joe Garcia, executive director of the Cristo Rey Community Center, which has been working since 1968 to provide access to food, medical care, and counseling for the most vulnerable in the Lansing community. That and more tomorrow on Current State. We hope you can be here. The executive producer of Current State is Peter Worf. Kevin Lavery directed our show today. Thanks also to Scott Pohl, Katie Cook, Jamie Paisley, and to Drew Hill for engineering. Don't forget the Current State podcast, informative, insightful, indispensable, anywhere, anytime at iTunes, Stitcher, or wherever you get quality podcasts. I'm Mark Bayshore. Have a great day. You've been listening to Current State on WKAR.